the workbook itself. A lot of times workbooks are very brief, a few comments with some questions. And I really think that the book of Corinthians is a fascinating book, one of the best books that we as Christians can dive into and learn from. So I wanted to develop a book that is kind of what I call a commentary workbook. It doesn't go in depth like a commentary. It doesn't talk about everything. But as you can tell, it's got a lot of information. And it's got some questions to challenge you. And we're all good Bible students here. If we put the time in, we can take a little deeper look in Corinthians and pull some more things out of it. And so I wanted to develop a book that could be used as a workbook. It could be used as a commentary. It also has some of these columns here that have kind of like some more information. And maybe some people want to know a little bit more about this or that, and that's what that's designed for. It's kind of pulled out of the book for those that may not want to know a little bit more about this or that, so you could skip that. And I try to do it with some wide columns so that even in the workbook you can put some notes in the columns and so forth as we go through this. Now, I wanted to say a little bit about the questions themselves. You'll see that there are some just basic questions. There's also, on page 10, if you want to turn there, there's also what I call a challenge question. Question number 4, challenge question. Or, like number 5, a thought question. So a challenge question is one that I think is a little bit more challenging, takes a little bit more thought, a little more study. And what I want you to do is I want you to try to find an answer. I want you to do some trying there, some research, and you should be able to come up with an answer, okay? But let's say you've been on this for 5-10 minutes, and it's just, you're just not finding it, not sure what to put, then go ahead and leave it blank, okay? I don't want you to spend an hour on one question here. But leave it blank with the idea that you're going to come to class prepared to see what we bring out on that. And that's really a great way to learn, right? Okay, I didn't find out the answer, or I didn't quite know what you're looking for. So come into class, and then it gets revealed to you, and it's going to stick with you a lot better that way. Thought questions are usually questions that really don't have a right or a wrong to them, but it's to get you to think about certain things in the text that maybe you haven't thought about before, and to draw an opinion of those. And again, then come to class and to see kind of what opinions other people have, and maybe it will open your eyes to some things. Maybe it will solidify what you already have opinion on. And so that's kind of some comments about the book. I hope you find it useful. I hope that you'll put the time in. So this week, what I'm asking you to do is I'm asking you to read 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Now, if you're really motivated, it would really be good to read all 7 chapters to put it kind of in a letter. Because as someone once said, the Corinthians, when they received this letter, didn't start reading, you know, the first 2 pages Sunday morning and then stop. And then they came back Wednesday evening, and then they read another page and stopped. That's not how you read letters, right? They read the whole thing. They read the whole thing. And so if you're really motivated, I encourage you to do that and get the context of all this. But at the least, I'd like you to read 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and do the questions in the book connected to chapter 1. Okay? I've tried to keep the questions down to a minimum so that you're not trying to answer about 20 questions or so. Instead, I think there's anywhere from 5 at most 10 in most lessons. So any questions about that? Nope? Okay. So if you would, in your books, turn to Acts... Wait, not 1 Corinthians? No. We're going to turn to Acts chapter 18, because this first class or two, we're going to just be talking about some background of the city. And I'm a big believer in the more that you know about the history, the culture, what was going on at that time, the more you will be prepared, or the more the text will stick out to you. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the city of Corinth. We're going to talk a little bit about the culture of Corinth. And some of this will go by a little bit quicker than others. Get what you want, get what you can from this. But here is a satellite view of Greece. And I don't know if you ever kind of look at or thought about this, but Corinth is very close to Athens. Okay, not too far apart. But to get from Athens to Corinth, you've got to travel through this little sliver of land. And this little sliver of land right here where Corinth is located is called the Isthmus. The Isthmus. And that's in your book. It has some information on that. I will let you know that in this area, there was a competitive games called the Isthmian Games. Okay? And it was kind of not as big as the Greek Olympics, but it was kind of a more minor status, secondary status to the Olympics. But it was where they would come together and they would compete. And hold your place in Acts 18 and go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. A lot of people, as Paul writes chapter 9, believe that Paul was thinking perhaps of those Isthmian games when he writes in 1 Corinthians 9 and in verse 24, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim, and I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified." And so you can see he uses the analogy of racing, of running, of boxing. And many believe that perhaps he used that because of those Isthmian games that Corinth was so well known for. So a little background on that. Now, Corinth is part of an area of Greece known as Achaia, okay? And so Achaia is not an island. It almost looks like an island, but there is this little sliver of land right here that's called, again, the Isthmus, that connects it. And so if you ever were to go into this area, and Tamara and I, back when we were in our early days, when we lived in Romania, we took some time to come down here to visit Athens and Corinth. You are definitely in an area where Paul walked. Paul walked somewhere, traveled somewhere between these two bodies of water. So you're very, very close to where Paul walked. And so this is really a very big, what we would call, peninsula. And there were churches. Corinth was probably the main or the biggest church. But there were other churches. In fact, the New Testament talks about the churches of Achaia. And you maybe never have really thought, where is Achaia? Well, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the churches of this area, this peninsula here. In fact, there was a city, I don't remember if it's on this side or that side, called Cenchrea. It's the port city, one of the port cities of Corinth. And so Corinth was actually inland, and Cenchrea was the port city. And so as ships would come into this area, they would dock at Cenchrea, and oftentimes sailors, which we'll talk about, would go into Corinth. Okay? So go over to Romans 16. Hold your place again in Acts 18. And go over to Romans 16, where Paul talks about a Christian lady, a Christian woman. And look at what he says about this servant of the Lord. He says, I command to you, this is chapter 16, verse 1, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, who is a servant of the church, which is at, do you see it? Cenchrea. So Phoebe was a member not of Corinth, but of that port city, Cenchrea. And so we know of one member, at least, that is mentioned in the New Testament of Cenchrea. Now, today, if you were to go to this isthmus, this is what it looks like today. They have cut out of the rock there a canal. And in fact, if you're so inclined, one time a year, I believe, they allow you to swim from one side to the other through the canal. Now, I know David Cruz would like to do that, right? But I'm not sure about rest of us. And so here is a picture of a ship going through the canal. And again, you can imagine the reason this was done is, one, you're saving a whole lot of time crossing here as you head back, as you're traveling here or here. Not only that, as you would travel, if you had to travel here, as you come out here to the open ocean, you're going to hit all sorts of wind and storms and so forth. So it actually was a shorter distance, but it made it safer as well. And so they cut this canal. But here's the thing. That wasn't around in the days of Paul. But they still would move ships from one side to the other, this side to this. So anyone have an idea, or have you ever heard, how did they do that without a canal? Well, I'm going to tell you. They would take logs, and they'd cut logs, and they put them one after another. And so they would take that ship, and they get ropes tied up to it, and they put it on those logs, and they'd pull it across from one side to another. Now you can imagine that would take some time. You would take some time to cross over. It would take some time to wait your turn to get across. And this is why we're interested in this. So what would happen? Well, the sailors would get off the ship and they would go into Corinth. Now, what would those sailors be looking to do? Party. It's time for some R&R, right? And that's why Corinth, as we will see, had a reputation of being one of the most immoral cities in the world at that time. So when we talk about Paul preaching at Corinth, I want you to think about us going to San Francisco with the gospel. And I'm talking about some suburb of San Francisco. I'm talking about downtown San Francisco. Any takers? Interesting, just recently, two young men, get this, from Alabama, have gone to San Francisco and are trying to start a congregation in the city of San Francisco. I believe they're about 6 months in. So you might think about that and keep them in your prayers. What about taking the gospel to Las Vegas? You say, well, there's Churches of Christ in Las Vegas. Yeah, outside Las Vegas, right? But what about in the heart of Las Vegas? So that will help you understand what Paul was trying to do as he went to Corinth. And one of the reasons, not the only reason it was so immoral, was because of this whole canal thing, the moving of ships, the sailors coming in. So we'll talk a little bit about that. All right, any questions or comments up to this point? All right. So here are some ruins of Cenchrea. This is the city of Cenchrea, the port city. And so they're not well preserved, but there are some ruins there that show that, as the Bible talks about Cenchrea, it really did exist. Now here is an artist's rendering of what the city laid out, looked like in those days. We're going to see, I believe this is the Temple of Apollo. We're going to see some ruins of that. We're going to see the theater. And right here, I believe this is the marketplace. But it gives you a good idea, because oftentimes as we talk about these cities, we just look at the ruins. And it doesn't give you the greatest mental picture of what a city looked like. And so I wanted to show this to you. And we're going to take a little bit of a look at the city itself in ruins as we move forward. And here we do that. So one of the things I want you to try to get your bearings to, here to, I believe it's the north, is this big mountain called the Acro-Corinth, the Mountain of Corinth. And this was kind of the main street, the main thoroughfare, what we might call Main Street. They called it the Lakeion Road. And so you would come into town from down here and up here. If you keep going down this road, you're going to run into Cenchrea. And so this would be the road that you would take to the seaport. And so again, you're looking at a road that Paul has his footprints on right here. You'll notice that there are either houses or shops over here. You see a few columns still standing. Again, it must have been a relatively, for that day and age, a beautiful city by Roman standards. There is a museum there at Corinth, and you can see they have highlighted the different columns that they discovered in Corinth, some more decorative, some more basic than others. And here's a good example of three columns that exist that have survived. These are the three surviving columns of a very large temple. It's not the only temple, obviously, but this is the temple dedicated to the god Apollo. And so this is the temple to Apollo. We'll see some other pictures of that. What you have here is what we would probably call a signpost. And you can see engraved in that is the word synagogue. These are in the Hebrew letters. And so they actually believe they know the location of the synagogue in Corinth. So let's go to Acts 18 And let's talk a little bit about Paul's first contact with Corinth. So in Acts chapter 18 and verse 1, it says, "And after these things, he," that's Paul, "left Athens, and he went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome, and he came to them. And because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers." So here's that passage where we learn what Paul did as a trade or as a profession. He was a tent maker. And so he hit it off with Aquila and Priscilla. We'll talk about them more in a second. But verse 4, "And he was reasoning in the synagogue," and there's the signpost for the synagogue, "every Sabbath, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks." Now let me ask you, how are you going to persuade Greeks in a synagogue? The proselytes, or sometimes referred to as the God-fearers. There were actually Greeks that became converts to Judaism, accepted the Jewish way of life and the Jewish religion, even though that they were Greeks. And so sometimes they're called proselytes, sometimes they're called God-fearers. There's a debate a little bit as to what's the difference. Some believe the difference is a proselyte would be one who actually circumcised himself. A God-fearer was one who did everything but that. And so there was actually a section in the synagogue where the God-fearers could sit and listen and learn and worship God. And so they were not allowed to sit in the same area as the actual Jews, but the God-fearers could have their own section. So it would be kind of like, you know, the Jews would have inside here, and we put the God-fearers in the cry room or something like that. Okay? And so Paul was preaching both the Jews and the Greeks in the synagogue because of that. And so that's kind of all it really tells us at that point about the synagogue worship. And we know Paul's custom was on every Sabbath. He would go in there and he would try to persuade men, try to teach them. And we'll talk a little bit more about the synagogue and its worship service in a later lesson or a little bit later. But there is the synagogue signpost. Again, this is that main road, the Lakeian Road. And I show you this picture because they found that signpost somewhere among these ruins. I'm not sure if it's this side or this side. And so they believe right here you might be at some place looking at the actual synagogue of Corinth. Okay, so let's go back to Acts 18, because what we're looking at here is actually mentioned in the Bible. You'll notice again, there's that mountain. So it gives you kind of a point of reference. There's that Acro-Corinth. All right, so let's begin in verse 5. "When Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ." Now, a couple things here. We are told he hits it off with this couple, Aquila and his wife Priscilla. Okay? And a big connection was because they had the same trade. And so when Paul came to Corinth, he was preaching, but he was also doing what? Tent making. Exactly right. Now, there's a little bit of discussion whether Aquila and Priscilla were already Christians or if Paul converted them, because he never talks about ever baptizing them or converting them. My view of that is that they were some of his first converts. But again, there's no text on that. And so they actually house Paul for a little while, and they become the New Testament Christian couple in a positive sense. The only other Christian couple that are even really described is Ananias and Sapphira, right? And they don't last very long because of their sin. But can you think of any other Christian couple that really is talked about and highlighted in the New Testament? You know, Peter had a mother-in-law, so you know he had a wife. In fact, in Corinthians, again, chapter 9, Paul will talk about how the apostles took along believing wives, but he doesn't really describe anything. And that's kind of the interesting thing, is you don't have a whole lot of Christian couples highlighted in the New Testament church, the New Testament times. I'm not saying there weren't them. I believe there were probably quite a few. But Aquila and Priscilla become the Christian couple of the New Testament. And whenever you see one mentioned, you'll see the other mentioned. They're always mentioned together. And as a Christian couple, they become a great example of how you can use your marriage as an asset to building up the kingdom of God. They become some of Paul's closest co-workers. In fact, in the book of Romans, he'll talk about how they risked their lives to save Paul's life. He doesn't give us the details of exactly how they did that or when they did that. But that's the couple that they were. In fact, when Paul leaves Corinth, he is going to take with him Aquila and Priscilla. And remember, when he leaves Corinth, he goes over to Asia Minor. He gets to Ephesus. And he wanted to go to Ephesus all along, but remember, God said no. And he didn't allow him to go to Ephesus. Well, now he's in Ephesus, but he doesn't stay there very long. He wants to get down to Jerusalem, and so he takes off, and he leaves Aquila and Priscilla in Ephesus. And so you talk about the church in Ephesus growing strong and having lots of members. Well, Paul starts it, but the one that does a lot of the watering, another term, another analogy Paul will use in Corinthians, is Aquila and Priscilla. And finally, at the end, we find them in one more place. We find them in Corinth, Ephesus, and then back in Rome. And so they're back in Rome as the time by the time he writes Romans, they're back there. And so they were from Rome. They were from Italy. They were Jews from Rome. And imagine how difficult it would be to be a Jew in not only a Roman city, but the capital of the empire, where the emperor himself lives. If any of you got to see the movie The Apostle Paul that recently came out, it gives you a very good sense of what it was like to be a Christian during the time of Rome. I would imagine being a Jew would be kind of the same challenges as well. And so it tells us that Silas and Timothy weren't with Paul, but now they were. And what had happened is that he had sent them back, one, I believe, to Berea, and Timothy to Thessalonica to check on the brethren. And now they came down, and it's interesting because it says that when they came down, Paul stopped doing what? Yeah, stop making tents. And so many believe that, and he'll talk about this in 2 Corinthians, that they came with money to support Paul so that he could preach the gospel without having to provide for himself by tent making. Okay? So Paul now has this support. He has robbed other churches to preach to the Corinthians. And so look, if you would, at verse 6. It always happened. At some point, and when they resisted and blasphemed, that's the Jews, he took out his garments. He shook out his garments, and he said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on I will go to the Gentiles." Then he left there, and he went to a house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. That's another term for that God-fearer. Sometimes they're called proselytes, sometimes they're called God-fearers, sometimes they're called worshipers of God. All right? And so here's this Roman man, a worshiper of God, and he invites Paul, and look at where his house is. His house was next to the synagogue. So Paul gets kicked out of the synagogue, and how far does he have to go to find another place to preach? Across the street. It's amazing, the providence of God. So what happens? So he's in the house of Titius Justus, and he's preaching, he's teaching. And look at who becomes one of the first converts. Verse 8. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue. He believed the Lord with all of his household, and many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. What's a synagogue leader? In a way, like a priest, right? He was the one that was in charge of everything in the synagogue. He was the one that was in charge of choosing which scriptures they were going to read and getting that all ready. He would be the one that would call upon the men to read the scriptures and open it up for discussion. And so he himself may not be the teacher, in a sense, but he was the one that kind of led everything. And his responsibility was for the synagogue service. And so imagine that. That's an important role. That's a prestigious role among the Jews. And this man gives it up to become a Christian. And so verse 9. Sometime after that. And this is very important. The Lord said to Paul, verse 9, in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer. Go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city." I want you to think about San Francisco. God says, "I got many people in the city." Las Vegas, how immoral it is. But God says, "I have many people in this city." That's powerful, isn't it? And so here's a verse, the only verse I ever could think of that I ever have known that says Paul was afraid. I mean, we always talk about Paul, he's like subhuman. He gets stoned and they think they've killed him, and he gets up and he keeps preaching. Nothing stops him. But here at Corinth, there's something that happened. That Jesus comes to him in vision at night and says, "Stick with it. Stay here." And he gives him this promise that no man will harm him. To hurt him, to harm him. Now that gets a little confusing as we read on. Look, if you would, in verse 12, the very next story, look at what happens. Let's begin in verse 11. And so Paul settled there a year and 6 months. We often talk about Paul being there 18 months, a year and a half. But he probably was there longer because it's at that point that the year and a half starts. It doesn't include what we've already talked about. So he probably was there longer than 18 months. And then verse 12, but while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, that's what we would call governor, he was the governor of Achaia, so that peninsula, that was his territory of reign. The Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat. That's what I wanted to get to. So Gallio sat in the judgment seat, and they brought Paul before him. What you're seeing here, where'd that go to? Is what's called the Bema. And this is what's being referred to. So this was like a stage, if you will. There were probably columns that rose up here with a roof. And then there was like a throne. And that's where the governor would come and he would do his business and he would hear the people and he'd make his rulings. And in fact, right here is a little sign that says the judgment seat. In Greek, the Bema. And so Paul was somewhere right here, somewhere in front of Gallio. And that's what we're reading about. And so they brought him before the Bema, the judgment, saying, this man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or vicious crimes, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names of your own law, look after it yourself. I am unwilling to judge these matters. And so he drove them away from the judgment seat. He drove away from the Bema. Okay? And then look at verse 17. I don't want to discuss this too much, but I want you. And then they took hold of Sosthenes. What was Sosthenes' job? He was synagogue leader. Well, maybe they had two, but it might be more likely he was the one that replaced Crispus. The one that replaced Crispus, because Crispus became a Christian. One final thing before I close. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. Who's the new synagogue leader? Sosthenes. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. Paul, called as an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God. And who's with Paul? Sosthenes, our brother. So it's quite possible, though some argue against this, I think it's quite possible, Paul converted two synagogue leaders. They couldn't keep synagogue leaders in staff because of Paul. And so on Wednesday night, we'll talk more about some of this background and look at some more pictures of the city itself. Thank you.